Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, you heard in the news, says that she was forced out as a survivor of mental and physical abuse by her former husband, that she survived sexual assault in college. We'll talk about it tomorrow on our News Buzz edition of River to River. Also, the worries of one furloughed federal employee here in Iowa, worries about herself and her family, also worries about Iowa's presidential museum. Catch your News Buzz tomorrow, our handful of quick conversations about the news that we didn't get to otherwise during the week. Well, with all of the political turmoil in our own country, you may be forgiven for not keeping up to speed on the intense politics elsewhere, particularly in South America. Joining us to help us understand what's going on in a couple countries there, Amy Erica Smith, associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Amy, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. It's great to be here.
Let's focus on Venezuela. Big headlines there this week, particularly yesterday. Let me recap those for those who might not know. An opposition leader has claimed control of Venezuela yesterday. Juan Guaido, if I'm getting his name correctly.
Guaido.
Mm-hmm. Guaido declared himself Venezuela's legitimate president. Now, U.S., Canada, many other nations recognizing his leadership now. Amy, start by giving us some background on the events to help understand what happened yesterday.
Okay, well, I'm going to take you back to 1999, which is the beginning of Hugo Chavez's turn as president. So to understand this, you have to understand what everything that has come before it. So Venezuela, I guess I'm going to go even back further back. I'm going to go into the 70s. Venezuela has long been, or for many decades, was one of the richest and most democratic countries in Latin America. It has tremendous oil wealth, and during periods when many other countries in Latin America were doing very badly, Venezuela was doing really fantastically economically and was known for a prosperous, stable democracy. Coming into the 1990s, though, there began to be some economic stagnation, and voters started to see politicians as sort of out-of-touch elites who didn't really understand what was going on with them. And coming out of the in the 1990s, Hugo Chavez began to grow in popularity and ultimately was elected president. So Hugo Chavez very slowly started a long, slow process of dismantling democratic institutions in Venezuela. And ultimately, he died of cancer in 2013, was replaced by a guy named Nicolas Maduro, who really deepened the authoritarian regime in Venezuela. So we gradually see democratic institutions coming apart and democratic checks and balances being eliminated. But throughout this whole time, they continued to have elections. They were just gradually rigging elections, and elections were becoming less and less free and fair.
Mm-hmm. Was there less and less popular support, or was mm-hmm. there some degree of that during this time as well, toward these steps towards authoritarianism?
Well, so Hugo Chavez was really popular. So the whole time that he is subverting democratic institutions and removing checks and balances, getting rid of the powers of the legislature, he's also really popular. He has a strong base of popular support. It turns out, though, that his replacement, Nicolas Maduro, who is currently, I guess, still de facto the president in Venezuela, though Juan Guaido has some claim to be president now, Nicolas Maduro was not nearly as good a politician as was Hugo Chavez.
Mm-hmm.
So we gradually see where Hugo Chavez had been subverting the legislature, basically removing power from anybody who disagreed with him. Nicolas Maduro continues that trend and is gradually erasing more checks and balances. And the other thing that's happening during this whole time as well is that the economy is falling apart.
Right. This is really bad. I've been watching pictures on TV. I mean, describe what everyday Venezuelans are facing now.
Something like 80% of Venezuelans get two or fewer meals a day. We're talking, and I'm not sure what the percentage is who gets just one meal a day, but it's a really very high. The country, I mean, so what happened was rampant inflation because they were printing money basically in order to pay for government debts. They were printing money, and at the same time, so Venezuela is extremely oil rich, but through mismanagement, they have managed to run the state owned oil industry into the ground. What's called PDVSA, PDVSA, Petróleos de Venezuela. So they've managed to run the state-run oil industry into the ground, and also to result in, it looks like it's hard to get a good number on inflation these days, but it's like up in the hundreds of thousands or even million percent a year.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got rampant inflation at this point where prices are being changed throughout the day. You go into the store in the morning and a price is different than it will be in the afternoon. And with this kind of inflation, ordinary people, you know, are just losing, are not able to pay for things.
Mm-hmm.
One of the worst things has been that they are not accepting international aid.
Right. Okay. Let's get quickly up to yesterday's event. Juan Guaido, recognized by the U.S., mm-hmm. Also other countries, I believe the EU, Canada, as Venezuela's legitimate president. Why have the U.S., along with other countries, sided with this president against Maduro?
Okay. Well, so first of all, the his claim to legitimacy comes from the fact that there was an election held in April that was widely recognized to be illegitimate and fraudulent. So what happened was the Venezuelan Constitution called for an election in October, and they... in October of 2018, but sometime in January of 2018, President Maduro, Nicolas Maduro, just said, I don't think we're going to have it in October. I think maybe we should have it early. Let's have it maybe in January or February or, you know, March or April or something like that. We'll try to figure it out, but we'll have it early, which is not the way constitutions work, or not the way they're supposed to work. Eventually, they figured out, you know, we can't actually, like, run the election until April. That's not technically possible. So they eventually end up running the election in April. So they hold it early with basically nothing other than it's Nicolas Maduro's whim that they're going to hold it early. And then they disqualify almost all of the major parties from running against him. And so he wins an election in which he's basically the only major candidate who's allowed to run. But they don't have electoral observers in the country. No electoral observers are allowed to see whether the voting is free and fair. So in many ways, it's just not widely accepted as a free and fair election. What happened? So January 10th, Nicolas Maduro was inaugurated for his new term in office, and the opposition, which had long been fragmented and weak as a result of both. For the errors that they had, errors of their own, political errors and other problems, the opposition took the inauguration of Nicolas Maduro as sort of a moment to rally and to state firmly and emphatically that they didn't perceive Nicolas Maduro's election as free and fair, and that they did not perceive him as a legitimate president of Venezuela because he had not been elected in a free and fair election.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the like sort of the basis for what's happening. The longer story is that the U.S. has opposed the Hugo Chavez / Nicolas Maduro regime basically since Hugo Chavez was elected president in a democratic election. So he was initially elected democratically, but he was always sort of this populist leader who gradually undermined checks and balances. But the U.S. has opposed him basically from the beginning because not only is he a populist, but he's a leftist.
How much does this have to do with Venezuela being one of the closest allies to Russia? I saw today Russia accusing the U.S. of trying to usurp power in Venezuela, warning the U.S. against military intervention. How much is that part of it? It almost sounds like it's a renewed sort of proxy conflict similar to what we had during the Cold War in South America.
Yeah, that's interesting. So Russia is a relatively late player in this whole game. Which is not to say that Russia didn't have some role, but Russia's role has been increasing. As Venezuela has been falling apart and increasingly unable to support itself, Russia is helping to stabilize the country. So when Hugo Chavez came to power, he was not by any means, he was not particularly affiliated with Russia. I don't think he was particularly, I don't know that he had particularly hostile relations with Russia either. It was just Russia was not really part of the game. Mm. But what's happened is that over the past 5 years or so, the Venezuelan economy has fallen apart. It has tremendous oil reserves. And because of that, is sort of a natural ally to Russia in the sense that they, in the sense of the sort of this oil economy, and they, and Russia has seen an opening in terms of being able to form an ally with Venezuela and prop the Venezuelan regime up.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Amy Erica Smith is with us in the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University with obviously a focus on Latin America in her work. We've got a few more minutes to talk about this, five more minutes, and I want to get to the key parts here with Erica before we switch to briefly talk about Brazil as well. So what do you see as the possible scenarios going forward with this development this week in Venezuela? Putting the economy back together, is it conceivable that Maduro's government could fall overnight? Is it that sort of on the edge?
Well, so what's happened right now is the United States, where we are as of noon today, and things could change by nightfall.
Yes.
But where we are as of noon today is that we have most of the major governments of the Western Hemisphere have declared support for Juan Guaido as the, quote, legitimate interim president of Venezuela, which is to say we don't recognize they don't recognize legitimacy of Nicolas Maduro, and they want they say that it's legitimate for Juan Guaido to sort of be the president of an interim transitional government until new elections are held. So yesterday, Nicolas Maduro kicked out diplomats from every country that had recognized Juan Guaido. And then Juan Guaido, the self-proclaimed interim president of Venezuela, says, no, actually, I'm not kicking you out, and I'm the legitimate interim president of Venezuela. So we've got dueling orders from the dueling presidents of Venezuela to kick out embassies.
And then Washington says it's not going to be kicked out. It's not going to ignore.
Right. And so Nicolas Maduro and his supporters say, well, or his government says, well, okay, we'll just turn off your lights and electricity and water, and we'll see how long it can last. So we're going to see what happens with that over the next, week or so. But beyond that, what will happen? Your question is what's going to happen?
Well, and also, of course, the threat of violence here.
Right. Yeah. So the threat... will Venezuela attack the American embassy? That would probably be a really bad idea. But is there going to be violence? One potential scenario that is very real and dangerous for Juan Guaido is that he could be arrested by the Venezuelan security forces, which are known for torturing political dissidents. So he's doing this at great personal risk. And it's very, very possible that he could end up, that this could end very badly for him.
Hmm. It all depends on the military, right?
It all depends on the military, right.
Mm-hmm. And what can you see there?
So it's hard to know. It's one thing that's clear is that there are many, among lower ranking officers and enlisted men, people are experiencing exactly the same hardships as ordinary Venezuelans themselves are. So there's a lot of discontent within the lower ranks in the military in Venezuela, and many of them would love to see Maduro out. Among the upper-ranking officers, probably most of them actually also want Maduro to go. It seems likely that many of them also want Maduro to go, but the danger of being arrested and tortured is really quite severe for the upper ranks of the military. So it's going to take all of them breaking together in order for it to happen. There was hope that yesterday would be the trigger that would lead to a mass defection within the military from Maduro. It does not appear that that has happened so far. So one, probably the most likely scenario coming out of this, unfortunately, is that the military closes ranks around Maduro for at least a while longer. That said, a coup could happen at any moment. But for years, people have been saying that a coup could happen at any moment because the regime has been falling apart at the seams for years now. So, and in fact, many coup plots have been averted. So, yeah, so it could fall apart at any moment, or it could keep going for another few years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's pivot over in the 5 minutes we have left. We're going to hurry up on this one,
yeah.
But very important to get to Brazil.
Yeah.
Amy Erica Smith with us, political science at Iowa State University with a focus on Latin America this hour. Let's pivot from to Venezuela's large neighbor in the south, of course, Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
Got a controversial president there, and he was at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this week, alarming some climate scientists. Tell us about him and what he's been saying about how the Brazilian resources might be used differently.
Okay. So Jair Bolsonaro is, he was elected in October 2018 as a major change from the prior president. So the past three president or four presidential terms had been won by the Workers' Party, the PT, which is a center-left party. The Workers' Party president was impeached in 2016, and they had had another president in place since then. So he's marked a sharp turn to the right in Brazilian politics.
If he was given a label, would you say he's far right, middle right?
I would say most people place him on the far right.
Okay.
And he, among the many things that he's done, or among the many things he's interested in, is opening up indigenous territories. Brazil has very large swaths of the Amazon, as I'm sure you and most of the listeners are aware. Much of the Amazon rainforest is located within Brazil. And a lot of it is demarcated as indigenous territories, indigenous reservations, as well as actually territories that are dedicated to communities of escaped slaves who escaped from slavery back in the 19th century and established their own communities. So there are these very, very large territories, and he has been so much of the rainforest is protected. And he campaigned on, and since as president, has been saying that he's going to eliminate a lot of the protections for indigenous territories. And he's framing it in terms of we're going to integrate the indigenous into Brazilian society. But what he really means is we're going to get rid of protections for their territories.
And he can do this. In his position, he has the power in Brazil to do this.
Some of this will probably need legislative approval. One of the very first things that he did, though, that was within his purview. So actually, the legislature has not even taken power. He was inaugurated January 1st, but the legislature doesn't even come in. The legislature is in recess right now and won't start a new legislative session until February 1st. But there's a lot of things that he can do as president without legislative approval. One thing he did when he first came in was to move responsibility for demarcating indigenous territories, indigenous reservations, and reservations for escaped slaves from the Bureau for Indian Affairs, which is where one might think it would normally go, into the Ministry of Agriculture. So what he's effectively doing is taking rights away from indigenous groups and giving them to agribusiness interests. Mm. Which are diametrically opposed to indigenous interests, since, of course, agribusiness wants to take over the territory that was owned by or controlled by indigenous groups.
Okay. So, yeah. We've got 2 minutes left. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get to also why we should care here in the United States. Of course, those who care about the climate change should care.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. We have a lot of farming manufacturing going to Brazil, I know, right?
Right, absolutely, yeah. So we have a lot of farming manufacturing going to Brazil, and at the same time, Brazilian agriculture competes with American agriculture.
Right.
So here in Iowa, we should care a lot about that. In fact, Brazilian agriculture has benefited from the U.S. trade war with China, because China has diverted a lot of purchase of soybeans and those kind of things to purchase to Brazil. So, yeah, so on the one hand, it affects us because the Brazilian agribusiness is connected to Iowa agribusiness. And it also affects us because of the fate of the Amazon rainforest. The Amazon rainforest is a major sink for carbon. Deforestation of the Brazilian rainforest will massively affect climate change across the globe.
And in the final less than a minute here, what are you looking at when you watch Brazil? What will you be watching in the coming days and weeks?
So from the Brazilian politics side, right now, President Jair Bolsonaro's son is wrapped up in a major scandal where it looks like he's connected to death squads, as well as to other kind of corruption schemes, which could massively affect Jair Bolsonaro's presidency and affect his strength going into the legislative season. And that could, if he is hamstrung, he could end up, that could really end up affecting his ability to do all kinds of things, including a lot of the environmental policy or anti-environmental policy that he's interested in.
Fascinating. Amy Erica Smith, Associate Professor in the Department of Political Science at Iowa State University.
Thank you, Ben.
Digging into the details here about what's been happening in a couple of our Latin American neighbors. Amy, thanks for coming into our studio today.
Thank you so much, Ben.
Tomorrow on our program, the worries of one furloughed federal employee here in Iowa. We'll hear about her worries about herself and her family, but also worries about Iowa's Presidential Museum in West Branch. River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Caitlin Harrop. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Thank you.